Friday lunchtimes next week at 1 o'clock.
And that's here on BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM. On digital radio, you can also listen to us live online in high-definition sound. It's midday and time now for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
The instantly recognisable melody from Chariots of Fire. The Greek composer Vangelis is largely self-taught as a musician, but he studied painting and still paints. However, he is chiefly known for his electronic scores, of which Chariots of Fire was the one that first established him, I suppose, and he has had many awards for that score. Vangelis has also composed for films like Blade Runner. How did you find yourself composing when you were not a trained musician but were a trained painter?
You know, I think it's always a completely different thing, painting and composing. The common thing I have is that I'm very spontaneous. And when I'm sitting in front of my piano, my keyboards and all that, I hardly know what I'm going to play and what's going to happen. And then something is coming out. And that's it.
Because you began by doing quite a bit of electronic music with other musicians before the film scores, didn't you? So you'd already found a means of expressing yourself.
You see, the fact that I never been to a proper music school, which I think maybe I'm wrong, but I think that I was very lucky not to do, right? That gave me a kind of freedom to be within the rules of music, but not the rules of music schools. This is a completely different thing. And the electronic, I mean, the synthesizers, which in one hand can create uncomfortable sounds and all that. At the other hand, if you find a way, they can go more than the acoustic instruments because...
Be more expressive.
Yeah, if you can make them expressive, because it's the problem of the electronic instruments is the ergonomic problem, how they are designed, not the source of sound. And unfortunately, the designers that never made a synthesizer as good as a, let's say, as a violin, as good as a piano. And this is the problem.
It's interesting, we're talking about pure acoustic sound, and a lot of the music you've chosen wonderfully demonstrates great orchestration. And in fact, the first piece is chamber music, but it uses the instruments wonderfully. It's very French.
I think to write a piece of music like this, you have to be wise. And Debussy wrote this piece, towards the end of his life. I mean, he died very young, but I mean, it's amazing how he uses the dialogue with three instruments. Mm-hmm. And of course, people can say this is a matter of taste. I think it's a masterpiece.
Thank you. The third movement from Debussy's Sonata for Flute, Viola and Harp, played by the Melos Ensemble with Oceanellis playing the harp. Obviously the way in which you work when you're composing is very different. If I understand this correctly, you improvise quite a lot and you feed several instruments into the system at once.
Yes, this is something that actually the electronics instruments helped me to do that. And maybe I have to explain a little bit how I do it. For example, when we heard this kind of a symphonic sound of Chariots of Fire at the beginning, this is one example of playing any kind of music once, one take, with no overdubs. So I have in front of me my score, in front of me it's all the sounds. So I managed to overcome the difficulties of the playability of the ergonomy, if you want, and then to have immediate access to anything I want, anytime I want. So any family of sound, electronic or acoustic or whatever, because today with samples we can have everything, I can have it, you know, immediately. So by playing that way, I compose, orchestrate and execute at the same time. And to me, I tell you why it's very, very important, because I shorten the distance between the moment of, let's call it inspiration, and execution. And then I don't allow thought. I don't want to think. Because if I think, I will judge. If I judge, then I will be the judge of what I'm doing, and then it won't be as fresh.
In the 60s, you were playing with Aphrodite's Child, and then you nearly played with Yes. I mean, you experimented with that. That led to you working with John Anderson. So I assume that thing, that fresh thing of playing straight away the sound you were going to create rather than thinking about it too much before, it must have come from that when you did film music, you still wanted the kind of improvisatory feel.
Yeah, because I believe the result is much better like that. When I compose for films, I have the scene I have to play, and I just play, and that's it. And normally the first synthesizer is a symphony orchestra, isn't it? Because you have one instrument, two, three, but when you go to 50 or 80, 100, 120 people, you know, it's incredible.
Well, that's what we're going to next, Vangelis, because we're going to music from the Rite of Spring. And curiously enough, although you might think that this is music that was heard entirely in the head, in the way that he does those repeated chords, you know, boom, boom, boom,
boom, boom, boom, yes, yes, yes,
boom, 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 actually, it's E major in one hand and E flat in the other.
Yeah.
So he probably heard that at the piano, because it's two triads. They lie right under the hands. So maybe even for him there was an element of the way you compose.
I watched one day a documentary about Stravinsky, and when I saw the piano it was composing this, it was out of tune completely. And he uses a small pencil and rubber. Of course, that's another genius, and of course he had that in his mind. But I'm sure that Stravinsky had the system that I have in front of me, would have done it the same way, and maybe happier.
And don't you think it must have been amazing to everyone to hear this opening with a bassoon right at the top?
That's unbelievable. You see, this is the genius, because he could have put another instrument. Why the bassoon? I mean, that's incredible.
I bet it gave the bassoonist a bit of a shock.
Yes.
Thank you.
It sounds amazingly fresh now, 100 years later, but what it must have sounded like to audiences.
Disaster.
Well, the ballet was a disaster.
Yeah, because I think at the time, maybe it sounds like completely savage thing, but the content is there. And one of the contents that was said before is there. It's forever. It was shocking at the time because socially was not right, but musically was perfect.
We heard the opening of The Rite of Spring by Stravinsky, the composer himself, conducting the Columbia Symphony Orchestra. We talked about that lonely bassoon at the beginning, Vangelis. Yeah. And in a way, the instrument that we're going to hear next is like the sound of your soul, almost, isn't it? Especially as written here in the Bach.
Before Bach is music, right? And music is before human being. And the great gift, I think, we have is to understand music and to produce music. So this language, which is a code, to me is a code, is a universal code, contains all the secrets of the universe and at the same time is the proper language for the soul. Because what else you can, what language would you use for your soul? Nothing else, by music. And then Bach, he has his structure. It's so difficult to try to explain something which is divine. And sometimes whatever we can say sounds ridiculous. You can't throw one note away. Everything is placed. And that's why Bach is always going to be Bach. Also the cello, because he has the human range of,
something that... the human voice, yes.
The human voice, that's something that touches automatically the people. But of course you can hear a cello and say, my God, that's terrible, at the same time.
Yes.
Yeah.
That won't be what happens here.
No, of course.
Thank you.
It's incredible the way it leads up to that top note.
Incredible.
We heard Pierre Fournier playing the prelude from the cello suite number 1 in G major, BWV 1007 by Bach. Rachmaninoff next, Vangelis. A composer who was certainly no stranger to melody, and in this case is using somebody else's melody.
Yes, you see, he recognizes melody, he likes, and it's great that you take somebody else's melody.
What made you choose this?
Because there are some pieces that, although they're melodic, they contain a kind of enormous generosity and fills your everything, your soul. I mean, this thing, it's unique. It's therapeutic. It's not just another melody. It's full of kindness, full of love, full of generosity. That's why I chose this melody. Every time I hear that, I take a big breath of oxygen. Universal love. It's unbelievable.
I was going to say, I don't know about the word rhapsody, but I would say the word rapture.
Rapture.
It described your expression during that.
Yeah. You see, also, what I admire in Rachmaninoff is not afraid to express things melodically. Because more and more people, they're afraid, and they think that it's very silly to be romantic or to all that. And I don't know why. What created this fashion not to be so much introverted and not to express? Because I believe that everybody has this need.
We have an expression in England, to wear your heart on your sleeve.
Yeah, good.
Well, We heard the 18th variation from the Rhapsody on the theme of Paganini by Rachmaninoff, with Vladimir Ashkenazy playing the piano, and the London Symphony Orchestra conducted by Andre Previn. Now, that whole thing, Vangelis, of being in harmony, is a rather nice introduction to Wagner, to Tristan and Isolde, because that's precisely what he was trying to find, that harmony between two people here.
The impossible.
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 Yes, indeed, I remember one production of Tristan and Isolde, and they never touched. It was very powerful. But this is music which is very much the result of one man's sort of vision, isn't it?
And in that piece, what really impressed me is this kind of, through the whole piece, it's like you have one string, and this one string, it comes tighter and tighter and tighter until the end, and you can't breathe anymore. And
kind of unbearable tension.
Exactly, unbearable tension, yes.
Thank you.
You can see why people sometimes refer to that music as being dangerous, because it has a kind of edge to it.
Yes. All that is the da-di-da-di-da, that's it.
Yeah.
Three notes. The whole thing says to support these three notes on top. It's really extraordinary. Extraordinary.
The prelude to Act One of Tristan and Isolde by Wagner, the Staatskapelle of Dresden, conducted by the wonderful Carlos Kleiber. Well, Vangelis, it's Mozart we turn to next. And you've obviously got a little thing about flute and harp, because we had the Debussy earlier, and now we're going to hear part of the concerto for flute and harp.
The only thing I can say about that is that the two connections. First, that this piece of Mozart's, which actually Mozart, he never wrote for harp, so I think it's the only piece that he did. It was a commission by someone. He's never been paid for that. And somebody, you know, very wealthy man with his daughter. And that moment, what we're going to hear, it has the ingredients of Rachmaninoff's piece that we heard. The same generosity, the same love, and also because harp. For me, harp is not like other instruments. The harp is more connected, again, with the universal law. And to me, the harp has the simplicity to go to the source where music was born. But I think music was never born. It's been all the time. And then the flute, again, it's another instrument as important because this is the wind. So you have flute, harp, and maybe one percussion. That's all it is, and all that comes from there. This piece, this Mozart piece, it contains the same ingredients like the Rachmaninoff thing.
It's an interesting, I mean, that Rachmaninoff, we're talking about a romantic composer.
Exactly.
And here with Mozart, we're talking about a classical composer.
Exactly.
But there's one thing that binds them together.
Yeah, exactly. This is what I'm trying to say.
The Slow Movement from Mozart's Concerto for Flute, Harp and Orchestra in C, Kirkel 299. We heard William Bennett playing the flute, Ossian Ellis the harp, and the English Chamber Orchestra was conducted by Raymond Leppard. Vangelis, before we come to your final choice, I just want to ask you one thing. We've talked about the music that you love, and bearing in mind that you're a painter, I was wondering if you could give some idea of the kind of artists that you love. I mean, you've had Stravinsky, so I wonder if you like Picasso.
I do like Picasso.
Because there's a connection there.
I do like Picasso. And actually, Stravinsky and Picasso, they made so good and so bad at the same time. Mm-hmm. And, of course, someone which is impossible not to love is Van Gogh. And also, I can see a painting which is for somebody totally unknown, and I can love it. And definitely, I found out that the extraordinary painters are still the children. Children are amazing. Something that every conscious great painter must be a little bit jealous of children, how they paint.
This all chimes in what you were saying, that to a certain extent, too much tuition, too much schooling can be constraining, and
always.
That you get a kind of innocent freedom if you can be creative just straight from the heart, as it were.
You see, all this training and all this schooling, how you want to call it, I think it would have been better to try to help you to find what you have in yourself and to be better, instead of trying to make you like everybody else.
Yes, some people would say that if you have the training, it gives you the means to express yourself on paper, because not everybody can do what you do, which is to create straight on to your instruments in the way you do. That's
but maybe I do it because I've never been to music school. Mm. Imagine if I was there. Because I was obliged to find a way to express things very quickly. And if I have an occasion one day, if we can meet and I show you my spaceship, it's like a spaceship. And okay, it's impressive to see it, but more impressive is to see how all the system, which is not computerized at all, is manual. Because I believe that our brain is the best computer in the world. I mean, whatever we know, computers are good for other things, but not for creation. And by not being computerized, I can be faster. I can compose a symphonic work in the time that the symphonic work lasts. It could be 15 minutes, half an hour, 20 minutes. It will be finished, mixed, conducted, composed, everything. So if the moment is very good, and if let's call it inspiration of inspired, that will be okay. Otherwise, it will be a disaster. So what? I mean, it doesn't matter. We're not obliged all the time to be successful. We're not obliged to make masterpieces.
Well, we very happily have arrived at one of the great jazz arrangers, certainly one of the great trumpeters, and here they're working with one of the people who wrote some of the most memorable melodies, thinking of George Gershwin, and of course, Porgy and Bess. And I'm sure you'd agree with me, Vangelis, that Gil Evans's arrangements are
unbelievable,
marvellous.
I think for me, when I heard Gil Evans' arrangements, because we're talking about brass now, brass sound. The only instrument which is not brass is the double bass. Everything was brass. And I was amazed how he used all the colors, so mature, with great sound, enormous sound, and also, of course, the choice of Miles Davis. And I think that this recording, it's a classical recording, it's forever.
We'll be right back.
Very good.
Gone from Porgy and Bess, arranged by Gil Evans from the original Gershwin idea. Miles Davis playing there. Well, Vangelis, thank you so much for revealing the real Vangelis. You're going to be furious with me now because I have to mention that Chariots of Fire is, in fact, in its stage version here in London.
Not at all. The contrary. I'm very happy because also I could never, of course, imagine after all those years that it's going to become a play.
Yeah.
And also a very successful play.
Well, the play Chariots of Fire is at the Gielgud Theatre in London, and the film has been re-released. Well, thank you so much for the choice in music, and I look forward to one day joining you on your spacecraft.
OK. Thank you.
Vangelis was talking to Michael Barclay. Next week in Private Passions, Michael's guest is Ez Devlin, designer of the closing ceremony of the Olympic Games. Private Passions is a classic arts production for Radio 3. The producer of today's programme was Sarah Cropper.
On Radio 3 from the BBC Proms, Bruckner's Sixth Symphony. The BBC Philharmonic and its new principal conductor, Juanjo Mena, fresh from an acclaimed Proms debut earlier in the season. And the world premiere of a new work by a composer closely associated with the orchestra, James McMillan. Tuesday night, BBC Radio 3 at 7:30.
Yes, it should be good. Juanjo Mena conducted the Bruckner Sixth Symphony with the BBC Philharmonic in a Radio 3 Live in concert a month or so ago, and David Fanning wrote afterwards in the Telegraph, "Rarely have I heard a Bruckner Sixth that displayed such masterful long-term vision. Never, I think, one that made the work seem so important." That's Tuesday night, live here on BBC Radio 3, starting at 7:30. 1 o'clock this Sunday lunchtime, and this is Jonathan Swain in London with a news summary. The chairman of the British Olympic Association, Lord Moynihan, has urged the government to rethink its policy towards sport on the back of Team GB's gold medal successes at the Olympics. He called for an increased budget for school sports. He also said there needed to be greater access for young people to sporting facilities and an end to the closure of playing fields. He added that now was a once-in-a-lifetime chance to inspire young people and increase participation in sport. Great Britain is currently third in the medal table with 14 gold, 7 silver and 8 bronze medals. Later today, Andy Murray will be competing for 2 tennis gold medals in the men's singles against Roger Federer and in the mixed doubles with Laura Robson. And British sailors, including Ben Ainslie, are also hoping for success. A Dubai-based television station has screened what appears to be footage of a group of 48 Iranians who were kidnapped in Syria on Saturday. Iran says the group were pilgrims to a shrine in the Syrian capital, Damascus. But in the footage, a man from the rebel Free Syrian Army said that some of the hostages were members of Iran's Revolutionary Guard. The Yemeni government has blamed al-Qaeda for a suicide bombing that has killed at least 40 people in the southern town of Jar. It's thought the town was recently recaptured from jihadists. An electrical supply problem has been causing widespread disruption at London's King's Cross rail station. Some services have resumed, but there'll be delays for some time. Dozens of homes have been flooded in heavy rain in North Somerset overnight. Firefighters were also called to a landslide in the area, although no injuries were reported. There's also been a flash flood in Jedburgh in the Scottish Borders, where a river has burst its banks. About 30 buildings were affected. And the weather forecast. Heavy showers will become increasingly widespread and slow-moving this afternoon, with hail and thunder in places and some localised flooding. South-east England, Northern Ireland and north-west Scotland will remain largely drier. And that's the BBC Radio 3 news and weather at 1:05. And it's time now to join Lucy Skeeping for today's early music show.
Magnificat. For much of the 1400s, one composer dominated the courts and cathedrals of Europe. His music was copied and performed wherever polyphony was practiced, and every other composer of the age was in some degree affected by his work. I'm talking about Guillaume Dufay, whose Magnificat we're hearing now. Dufay was born in northern France, but before he was 21, he was in Italy, moving from court to court in the service of some of the most powerful families. And amongst the most prominent and influential of them all was the Este clan of Ferrara. If you've been to Ferrara, you'll no doubt have been struck by the huge moated fortress that dominates its centre. It seemed extraordinarily grand for such a small city, but then this was the Este Palace. And it was here in 1471 that the first legitimate son of the great warrior prince Niccolo III was crowned Ercole I, Duke of Ferrara. They called him North Wind due to his icy personality. And yes, it wasn't all plain sailing for Ercole. An attempted coup by his half-brother nearly toppled him, and a war with Venice raged for much of his reign. But a good marriage to the daughter of the Duke of Naples connected the Estes to one of Europe's most powerful dynasties. And a year later, the good citizens of Ferrara had something else to celebrate, the birth of their new ruler's first child. Of course, everyone had hoped for a boy, but that would have to wait. The little bundle of joy held tightly in the nurse's arms and presented to the court in May 1474 was a girl. They called her Isabella, which means God's promise.
Thank you.
Magnificat by Guillaume Dufay, performed by Ensemble Clementic. Just a few months after Isabel d'Este's birth in Ferrara, further north in the Franco-Flemish city of Cambrai, Dufay passed away. His patrons had been popes and princes, and in a career spanning some 50 years, he had defined and indeed masterfully combined the very latest developments in harmony, melody and polyphony. But if his death marked the end of one era, well, Isabella d'Este would help create the next. And it really is striking just how often her name comes up when I'm researching material for the Early Music Show. Isabella would grow up not to be just a powerful woman, but one of the most influential figures in Renaissance history. And beautiful too, inspiring portraits from the likes of Titian and Da Vinci. This extraordinary daughter of the Duke of Ferrara would use her position, her glamour, her considerable intellect and her extreme good taste to forward the cause of an entire cultural movement. No wonder she was dubbed the First Lady of the World. But let's go back a bit. Isabella's artistic tastes had certainly been formed by her upbringing. Her father maintained a chapel which for some years was seen as the finest in Europe, even overshadowing the Vatican. And for more earthly entertainments, he hosted theatrical productions with elaborate scenery.